Pardon me, Ms. Wang.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I represent 9 men who were beaten, burned, shocked, stabbed, and sexually abused as a direct result of the policies and derelictions of the defendants in this case. The defendants contend that my clients have no remedy in the courts of the United States for the torture that they suffered. That position is contrary to our most fundamental constitutional principles.
More appropriately, is it contrary to any precedent of this court, or is your argument contrary to the precedent of this court?
Your Honor, respectfully, we submit that the arguments are contrary to Supreme Court precedents, as well as precedents of this court.
Their arguments or yours?
I misspoke. Your Honor, we recognize at the outset that this court has considered many of the same issues in the case of Rasool II, Rasool versus Myers on remand from the Supreme Court, and has decided some of the issues in this case against us.
What issues do you say remain that haven't been decided against you in precedential decision of this court?
Your Honor, as to our constitutional claims, I believe that there are two issues that have remained open after Rasool II. First, Your Honor, Rasool II expressly left open a central question in this case, whether the Due Process Clause forbade the U.S. Secretary of Defense and senior military commanders from implementing a policy of torture in Iraq and Afghanistan. As the Supreme Court held expressly in the case of Boumediene versus Bush, and as this court has now recognized in the Al-Nakhale case, that question turns on whether it would be impracticable and anomalous to apply the constitutional provision.
Boumediene in the Supreme Court did not deal with either this location or this right, did it?
That is right, Your Honor. But as the court recognized in the Al-Nakhale case, the test...
In Al-Nakhale, we held that the constitutional access to habeas corpus did not extend to the prisoners held in a war zone that was not within the de facto sovereignty of the United States, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but
well, that's
as
against you rather than for you, isn't it?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that as to the application of the impracticable and anomalous test, Al-Nakhale is distinguishable from the instant case. The reason is that Al-Nakhale was a habeas corpus action in which the petitioners were seeking to come to the court and ask to be released. This case presents very different issues, and the application of the impracticable and anomalous test would have a very different result. The plaintiffs in this case are merely seeking a post hoc damages remedy against defendants who are actually no longer in office. That presents different facts and different circumstances, and it would not be impracticable and anomalous to hold that the Due Process Clause forbids the defendants
from... Can we make this case turn on their not being in office? I mean, no longer being in office? That can't possibly be of legal significance, can it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it is because the Boumediene, the test that the court reaffirmed in Boumediene says that the test turns on the circumstances that are before the court. Those are the issues here presented in this case. Whether the test would apply the same way as to defendants who are still in office is something that the court need not reach here. Your Honor, the second issue that still remains open after Rasool II is the brief analysis, the issue as to whether special factors should preclude a Bivens action in this case.
Before we get to a Bivens, the preclusion question on special factors, as to the Bivens action, aren't you confronted with a qualified immunity problem at the very outset?
Your Honor, we do acknowledge that as to the holding that it was not clearly established that the Due Process Clause could apply,
Phrase it that way, but you first have to show it's clearly established that there is a right that is violated. Not
yes.
Whether it can apply, but whether there is a right. Well, it's clearly established that there is a right. And given that there are cases from this court and the Supreme Court that either decided the other way or left it in limbo expressly during the period of time when these events occurred, how could we hold that it was clearly established so that a reasonable military officer should have known it when the courts not even agree on whether it was available or not.
Your Honor, we acknowledge that the Rasool II opinion does seem to decide the issue as to whether the law was clearly established, whether the constitutional right was established. Most respectfully, we do submit that that was wrongly decided in Rasool II, and for the reasons...
When did this occur, the events that you're suing over, the alleged torture?
They occurred over the time period from 2002 to 2004.
Had Boumediene been decided yet at that point?
No, Your Honor, but as...
Eisentrager was the closest thing we had to authority on the applicability of the constitutional rights to aliens beyond the sovereign territory, right?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the Eisentrager case was distinguishable even before Boumediene was
you
decided.
You have to get to clearly established.
Your Honor, for the reasons...
You have to get to clearly established.
Your Honor...
It may be distinguishable, like Vice President Gore said there was no controlling precedent on the Buddhist temple thing, but you have to face the fact that this... You have to make it clearly established, don't you?
Your Honor, and our submission is that it was clearly established under qualified immunity doctrine, under Supreme Court precedents and the precedents of this court, that in fact the defendants knew and should have known that their conduct was unlawful and that it was a violation of the Constitution to engage in torture, and that it was also a violation.
Was it clearly established that these plaintiffs had a right?
Your Honor,
you're jumping that question as you do in your brief, and I don't blame you because you have a hard time with it, but that's the first question to be confronted, isn't it?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the qualified immunity cases teach that the question for the second prong of the Saussure versus Katz test, whether the law was clearly established, turns on whether the defendants were on notice that their actions were unlawful. The entire premise of the qualified immunity doctrine is that it forgives mere mistakes by innocent officials who are trying to carry out their duties. The cases cited by the defendants on qualified immunity all have to do with situations in which defendants' actions were close to the constitutional line. For example, in the excessive force cases, an officer engaged in some conduct against a prisoner, which may or may not have been unconstitutional at the time of the conduct. This case is entirely distinguishable because this conduct by the defendants, setting a policy to encourage and condone torture and tolerating torture once they had actual notice that there was a systemic pattern of torture taking place in Iraq and Afghanistan. Such conduct is not forgiven and not excused by the qualified immunity cases.
I think you started out by saying you agree the law of the circuit is otherwise, right?
Your Honor, we do acknowledge that the Rasool II holding...
All right, so I mean, as a principal matter, we can't overturn the law of the circuit. So on your second possibly unresolved issue, it has been resolved by the circuit. So tell me the first one again. I'm trying to understand.
Yes, Your Honor.
What it was you said. I mean, if you have a claim with respect to Rasool and the other cases that address your second issue, that's an en banc query, and you're free to pursue it. We're not free to overcome the law of the circuit as a three-judge panel.
Yes, Your Honor, understood.
Tell me the first one again, and how is that not resolved?
Yes, and I would note that we asked for the case to be heard.
Tell the first one again, please.
Yes, sir. There are two issues as to our constitutional claims. The first issue is that we would ask this court to decide the first question under the Saussure versus Katz qualified immunity test and to hold clearly that the due process clause did apply and did forbid the defendants in this case, the U.S. Secretary of Defense and senior military commanders, from causing the torture of our plaintiffs. The second issue, Your Honor, that Rasool II has left open for this case is whether special factors preclude a Bivens remedy. Your Honor, the Supreme Court most recently...
You get to that if you don't prevail on the other issue.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that... In the Rasool II case, the court decided both issues, and the special factors inquiry doesn't necessarily come after the qualified immunity analysis.
You misunderstood my question. You started out your argument by saying there are two questions that have not been resolved by the law of the circuit. the second of which was in this larger area of special factors, Bivens qualified immunity. And you've acknowledged that the qualified immunity question has been resolved by the circuit. Whether you agree with it or not, it's been resolved. What was the first one again, the due process forbidding the implementation of torture?
Yes, Your Honor,
tell me what your argument is there and what it is that there is available to you that has not been settled by the law of the circuit.
Your Honor, Rasul II expressly left open the question whether the impracticable, anomal, and anomalous test should apply generally to cases raising the application of the U.S. Constitution overseas to non-citizen plaintiffs. And we contend that the court here, in this case, should hold that the Due Process Clause did apply and did prohibit these defendants from causing the torture of the plaintiffs.
Such that there's a resulting cause of action under what?
Your Honor, the cause of action would be under Bivens, because the plaintiffs here were tortured as a result of the defendant's actions. That violated the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Are we going in circles?
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think so. We have acknowledged that as to the clearly established prong of the qualified immunity test, Rasul II is binding on this panel, and we do plan to seek en banc reconsideration of that issue.
Now, if that is the case, if it's been established that qualified immunity applies, aren't we answering a moot question if we take up whether the constitutional right that you set forth in the first one is there?
Your Honor, respectfully,
we decide that question, and then what? I think that's what Judge Edwards is asking, I think.
Well, as the Supreme Court held in Saussure versus Katz, and has now made optional under the Pearson versus Callahan decision, the courts in some cases should go ahead and decide whether the constitutional right was violated, even if it then holds.
That they could then go on to a judgment on the case, if there is a live case or controversy remaining. If there is another basis, and I think you have pretty nearly admitted it, maybe you have, that if there's another basis that moots the case anyway, then we would be rendering an advisory opinion, wouldn't we, if we answered that first question?
Your Honor, actually the qualified immunity doctrine, Pearson notwithstanding, does permit courts to reach the constitutional question, even if
there is a case or controversy.
Your Honor,
if we decide the constitutional question and then say, okay, there is a right, but we can't do anything about it, why have we decided the first question?
Well, Your Honor, it's not a matter of mootness. The qualified immunity doctrine in the case of Saussure versus Katz urges courts to go ahead and reach the constitutional decision when it's warranted, because otherwise the law will not move forward and the constitutional boundaries will never be established.
What this case is are you citing for that?
Saussure versus Katz.
Okay.
And in Pearson versus Callahan, Your Honor, the Supreme Court more recently has held that applying the qualified immunity two-step process is optional,
yes,
that courts may skip.
Yeah, but you're turning that case on its head. Courts may skip to that when that ends the case.
Right.
That's not a way of prolonging the case.
It's a cute argument, but you flipped it in a way that's why I wanted you to come back. I'm not sure what you're saying. That's not what the court had in mind. To just offer an advisory opinion, you can't prevail. You're conceding you can't prevail under the law of the circuit.
Your Honor,
it's not your fault. That's what the law of the circuit is. And if there's an en banc claim, then you try and raise it. But I'm trying to understand how you avoid the law of the circuit, and I don't think I'm understanding.
Your Honor, respectfully, Saussure versus Katz, the Supreme Court held that ordinarily courts.
Put it this way. Let's say we agree. You're right. Okay. Can you prevail?
Your Honor, we may not prevail if the court holds to Rasul II's ruling that the law was not clearly established. But we still request that the court reach.
Can you prevail? No. Just stick with me, okay, please, so I understand your argument. If we do what you ask, can your clients prevail in this case? Not as a matter of, well, we got some law fixed up. Can they prevail in this case?
No, Your Honor. The qualified immunity doctrine would hold that if the law was not clearly established, if that's the decision the panel reaches under Rasul 2, then our plaintiffs would not have relief. However, under Saussure versus Katz, which survives as an optional process for the federal courts after Pearson versus Callahan, the court can, and we submit should.
If it's going to close out the case.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think that's...
That doesn't make any sense, counsel. The Supreme Court is not going to tell us, even if they're going to go the other way, you should go ahead and jump a step in order to render an advisory opinion.
Well, Your
Honor... That is totally out of step with 2 centuries of Supreme Court jurisprudence.
Your Honor...
You're turning that on its head. You can skip the step if it's going to end the litigation, not if it's going to prolong the litigation.
Your Honor, respectfully, I believe that was the view of the dissenters in Saussure versus Katz, and they prevailed in Pearson versus Callahan to the extent that the court held that it is now optional for the court to first reach the constitutional question and then decide whether the law was clearly established. Your Honor, I did want to save some time for rebuttal. I'm happy to go on
it's
and answer.
It's optional to do that when that's going to end the litigation. It isn't optional to do that in order to prolong the litigation, counsel, to make us render an advisory opinion. If you're conceding that the result has to be that you can't prevail on the question after we jump to it, that doesn't make any sense.
Your Honor, respectfully, I believe the precedents do permit that, and the reason is that...
That's not what Saussure says. Saussure makes it optional under a directly opposite circumstance than the one we have here.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the qualified immunity test under Saussure was, number one, was there a constitutional right violated, and number two, was the law clearly established?
Mm-hmm. And if you
that was the sequence.
Saying there's no constitutional right, then the court said you can do that. You don't have to figure out clearly established or not. You can say there's no constitutional right. That ends it.
Yeah.
That's true, Your Honor, and what we're asking this court
so
to do...
You're turning that now to say, well, since you can do it that way, you can also do it, even if you know the answer to the next question is going to be one that will cause the plaintiff to lose, you can go ahead and give an advisory opinion on whether or not there's a constitutional right.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that is what the precedents hold.
Okay.
Respectfully, counsel, that's not what associate... When you say the precedents, you're getting in even more trouble. The precedents are we don't render advisory opinions. Okay, your time has ended. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
From the government.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Loeb from the Department of Justice, and I represent the United States of America, Secretary Gates, and the former Secretary of Defense. The district court here properly dismissed the plaintiff's claims. It explained our brief that the judgment should be affirmed. And as we hear this morning, even plaintiff's counsel admits that the claims are controlled by this court's decision in Rasul. I'm happy to rest on our briefs. I would just point out as to...
That, anybody have any questions?
I just wanted to ask one thing.
Sure.
Is it not the case, or what is your response to their suggestion that how does the law move along in situations in which it was not clearly established during the period of which you're talking about, but it has since become clearly established? Does the court not note that in cases or what?
It's true in the run-of-the-mill cases that a court has discretion in that regard. But here where the court already knows under controlling circuit precedent the answer to the second question that it's not clearly established and also knows the answer to the question of whether...
I don't understand the difference between the run-of-the-mill case and whatever it is.
Well, the run-of-the-mill case, the court hasn't grappled whether there's a clearly established right at all, and it hasn't grappled with the question whether there's a cause of action at all, and it's looking at everything for the first time. Here, we already have binding circuit precedent that there's no cause of action. We have binding circuit precedent that it's not clearly established that they have rights outside the United States regarding this very same kind of context. And we also have binding circuit precedent exercising discretion under making the judgment under Pearson that it would be inappropriate and contrary to the constitutional avoidance principles to then reach out and decide in this sort of, as you say, advisory way regarding the constitutional rights of aliens abroad.
Well, then when does the law become clearly established and how?
Well, first of all, you need a cause of action. A court shouldn't even be, jumping into these constitutional questions where the special factors counsel against recognition of a Bivens actions, and under binding circuit precedent, there is no cause of action here. So a court shouldn't be then jumping into saying, well, but if there was a cause of action in this novel area, we're going to tell you what the constitutional rights
are.
You
really want us to start trying to make a distinction between the novel cases and the run-the-mill cases? And
well, this,
don't we have to have some kind of set of laws to guide us in what we're doing here? I thought you were stronger when you were resting on your brief. I understand you had to answer Judge Edwards' question.
There is a discretion under Pearson. That discretion under Pearson was exercised there. That decision's controlling here. It says do not reach that issue. Moreover, let's say you were to reach that issue and then to rule for us on two other grounds or controlling, you would have established a adverse precedent to the government, which we couldn't even appeal to the embanked court and Supreme Court because we would have won, which would be a highly unusual circumstance, and we would counsel this court strongly against doing that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, going back to the qualified immunity issue, in Pearson versus Callahan, the Supreme Court held that judges should be permitted to exercise their sound discretion in deciding which of the two prongs of the qualified immunity analysis should be addressed first in light of the circumstances of the particular case at hand. The reason why we come before this court and ask for the ruling on the constitutional issue is that the defendants in this case are claiming that there are no limits on the political branch's power to conduct to engage in
That's
such conduct
not the
overseas.
Issue before us at all.
Your Honor, respectfully, the defendants have put
declaratory relief.
No, Your Honor,
declaratory relief, and you got a standing issue there.
Yeah.
Well, Your Honor, as to the declaratory relief issue, respectfully, the district court erred in dismissing our claim when there were specific allegations in the complaint showing that these plaintiffs were at risk of future injury and are at risk of future injury, even if they engage in no wrongdoing. For that reason, the Lyons Doctrine does not apply in this case, and we believe that the district court should be reversed on the declaratory relief issue. But coming back to the qualified immunity issues, I just want to emphasize that in Boumediene, as well as in Hamdi, the Supreme Court repeatedly emphasized that the political branches do not have the power to turn the Constitution on or off at will. If this court does not clearly establish that the U.S. Secretary of Defense violates the Constitution by authorizing torture, then there will never be a case in which that law will be clearly established. As the district court noted, it's lamentable.
I don't really understand that proposition. You have the next step of seeking en banc. You have the next step of going to the Supreme Court. If you want to get your rights clearly established, you have other ways to go. And if it doesn't happen, then it doesn't happen. That doesn't mean there will never be a case in which it will happen. It just means that in this case, we can't decide that issue.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, under the defendant's argument, there will never be a case in which the constitutional prescription on torture will be given its effect as long as the defendants are acting overseas. And we submit...
That may be the case. That may well be the case, but that's not a reason for us to decide it. We don't issue advisory opinions.
Your Honor,
lots of things we will never have a case to decide, but that doesn't mean somebody can come in and get our judicial imprimatur on their proposition.
Your Honor, respectfully, under the Pearson versus Callahan decision and the earlier decision in Saussure versus Katz, we believe that the court would not be issuing an advisory opinion.
I think we've been over why Pearson and Saussure are not holding it, what you're asserting them for, and I think your time is once again up. So thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted.